Donald Trump called him tough. Rush Limbaugh read one of his articles live on his radio show. Ann Coulter tweeted that article to her 1.5 million followers and declared, "Every sentence is perfect." Ladies and gentlemen, your host, former chief editor of the Jewish Press, Elliot Resnick.
Welcome to the Elliot Resnick Show. 2 weeks ago, Yeshiva University canceled a lecture I was scheduled to give on my book, America First, The Story of Saul Bloom, the Most Powerful Jew in Congress During the Holocaust. I was given two reasons for this cancellation. Number one, I participated in the events of January 6th. And number two, I publicly castigated Yeshiva University in the past. Now, both are true, but compare what I did to what some other individuals have done whose presence at YU, in contrast to mine, is tolerated. Let's start with Jay Layden. Jay was an English professor at YU's Stern College who left his wife and children and transitioned into a woman, becoming Joy Layden in 2007. He continued teaching at Stern College until 2021 when he retired due to illness. Then you have Aaron Kohler, a Bible professor of all things, who argued publicly in 2019 that we should ignore the Torah's views on homosexuality when they conflict with what he calls humanity. He is still employed by YU. I should also note that YU's social work school recently featured a female reform rabbi, quote-unquote, as a speaker at one of its events. In other words, YU tolerates outright heresy and sexual depravity, but it will not tolerate a historical book lecture by yours truly. Apparently, participating in the events of January 6th is far worse than espousing heresy. As far as my public criticism of YU is concerned, it's true that I criticized YU, but was I really supposed to remain silent as my alma mater publicly all but embraced the LGBT agenda? Was I supposed to remain silent last month when YU sold far-left books at its Svarim sale, but refused to sell a book I edited with Divrei Torah from Rabbi Meir Kahana, especially in the wake of October 7th? Here to discuss all this is Jonathan Gross, a graduate of YU, a musmach of YU as well, the author of several books, formerly the rabbi of Beth Israel in Omaha, Nebraska, and today a civil rights attorney who lives in Baltimore, Maryland. Rabbi Gross, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Elliot.
My pleasure, my honor. I know the cancellation of a history lecture is not that important in the grand scheme of things, but I think it's reflective of a larger problem. So I was wondering what you think about it.
Obviously, if you had a book about transgenderism, you would not have been canceled. That would have been the red carpet laid out for you. And they would have put out some statements. Oh, we don't agree with it exactly, but we are open to all kinds of different views and ideas. But they don't agree with what you have stood for in the past in a lot of different respects, the two that you mentioned. And therefore, they can't have that. So it does say something about what their true feelings are towards the LGBT issue.
And I find that very frustrating because YU always says they're a very wide tent. They're open to all sorts of views. We're a university, freedom of ideas, free exchange of ideas. We don't ban books. You know, that's what the medieval Catholic Church did. We don't do that. And yet suddenly when it comes to Rabbi Kahana, it turns into the medieval Catholic Church.
I agree with that. And I want to say, to focus in on a point, the fact that you are canceled demonstrates what Yeshiva University can and will do when it does disagree with someone. So the fact that they permit the quote-unquote LGBTQ whatever stuff shows very clearly that they do not disagree in principle with it.
I want to get to the whole LGBT agenda soon, but I want to do one or two other topics first. And also, I want to say that both you and I went to YU, and I think both of us are grateful for at least part of the education we received there, maybe even much of the education we received there. So I take no pleasure in criticizing YU, and I don't think you do either. But I'm doing so anyways for two reasons. Number one, YU has the word yeshiva in its name. So when it does something ungodly, it's a reflection not only on itself, but on Judaism as well. And number two, I think it's really important that people know what YU really is, because it presents itself to the public as a Torah institution, but time and time again, it reveals itself, I think, not to be. So if people want to go to YU, that's fine. But at least people should know that YU is unfortunately not the Torah institution it portrays itself to be. And in many regards, it's even arguably a left-wing institution.
I would say not arguably. I think it is absolutely a left-wing institution. And there are really two YUs. There is the institution, and then there are the students. And when you and I were there, I think we could safely say that you and I did not represent minority views. I mean, you know, you and I obviously are a little bit more outspoken than perhaps the average student. But I think all in all, during our time, I graduated in 2001, so we're going back almost a generation. In those days, the student body was one thing, and the rabbis, we had Rabbi Bromspiegel, Rabbi Parnas, Rabbi Kahn, and they would speak out against the institution. I remember Rabbi Kahn got in trouble one time for giving a Musar Shmooze in the Beis Medrash, where he criticized the institution. I remember Rabbi Parnas regularly would speak out against the institution. He reserved the last 15 minutes of his shiur on Thursdays to what was called the Shmooze, and he would give very insightful talks on important contemporary issues, and he did not hold back at any time. There were easily 150 people packed into that Beis Medrash. The Sichos Musar on, I think it was on, I want to say Wednesday nights, where Rabbi Kahn gave some of his controversial comments, those were packed. I mean, everyone would attend those. And I think that that was what the student body looked like. In those days, the institution was very much a left-wing institution. It just didn't affect us on a day-to-day basis. And you really had to pay attention to know that that was the case.
Right. And I think that's part of the problem that, yes, you could go to YU and keep your head down, just go to your shiur, take your kosher classes, because there are some that are not so kosher, but you could be told to avoid them and never pay attention. I've always found that the right wingers, I think it's true in Judaism and in America in general, they go about their jobs, go about their business. In the meantime, the left wing students, they get hired by the student newspaper. They write all the articles. And often the articles in the student newspaper wind up being left wing because all the right wingers are just busy studying Torah and minding their own business. And I think it's a problem, actually. I mean, I understand why people want to learn Torah and mind their own business. But if you don't get involved at all, if no one gets involved in public affairs, then you're leaving the entire arena open only to the left wing.
It's what we call institutional capture by a minority of very agenda-driven, let's call them leftists, but I think it's just agenda-driven totalitarians. And that is where they swim. They go directly to the top of these institutions because those are the only kinds of people that want those jobs.
What do you mean, left-wingers?
I don't like to use left and right. I think it's more like up and down, frankly. I think that what we call the so-called left, their views are not, I mean, I don't know how to define them as left-wing. I consider myself a liberal. I am against establishment, institutionalized power. I'm against big government. I'm against big corporations. I'm for freedom of speech. I fight against the government every day. I'm a liberal. So for some reason, they've called me right wing. Why? The people who are quote unquote left wing, those are the people who go directly to the establishment. They're the people who are running the biggest tech companies. They're the people who are running our government. They're the people who are running our institutions, our colleges, everything. Look at the Rabbinical Council of America. If you look at the rabbis who make up the Rabbinical Council of America and their views, they're all what we call, quote unquote, right of center. But if you look at the statements that come out from the small cabal that runs the institution, it's not different from the conservative or reform, frankly. How does that happen? It's because there's a certain type that wants to be in control, and they realize that the easiest way to do that is to capture these institutions.
But I think that because maybe that's true, we need to not be asleep at the wheel, which we often are. Like, there are enough RCA rabbis who have the right views that they can make sure this doesn't happen, but they don't.
Well, I'll say this publicly right now. This goes back to, I want to say it was 2008. I was a rabbi in Omaha, Nebraska, and I was pretty anti-establishment, and I realized that the institution was captured. So I decided to run for vice president of the Midwest. And in those days, basically all the elections were perfunctory, and they would happen at the convention, but nobody went to the convention. Often the candidates themselves didn't even show up at the convention. The convention was mostly for the out-of-town rabbis like myself in Omaha, Nebraska, who were desperate to get to a place where we could have some chevroshaf and some camaraderie. So it would be a bunch of out-of-town rabbis. I had the support of all the out-of-town rabbis who showed up at the event, which was held in Teaneck, New Jersey. And the rabbis who were local, they would show up maybe if Rav Schefter was speaking or something, but for the majority of the program, it would just be us. So I decided to run, and I was watching the ballot box very, very carefully, and I was very convinced that I had a substantial margin because everybody who was there voted for me, and kind of the establishment people who were either employees of the RCA or alternatively people who had to be there because they had positions, there weren't enough of them to defeat us. I took my eyes off the ballot box for a couple hours because I had a personal matter I had to attend to. And then I came back and they told me I lost by one vote. So I'm not going to speculate as to what happened, but it's not that right-wing people don't want to get involved. They do, but it's hard. And not to mention the fact that the quote-unquote left-wing, and I hate using that word, they have people who support them financially. I'm a civil rights attorney. I'm fighting for unpopular causes. And those causes are not funded. I do that a lot out of my own pocket, out of my own time. And nobody's running to fund the things that I fight for. But if I switched teams and fought for, let's say, to represent illegal immigrants, there's tons of funding. I could be making a lot of money doing quote-unquote non-for-profit work. So we don't have a George Soros. And there's a reason for that. I think that, we had President Trump, who was a billionaire, and they went after him, and they're trying to take away all of his wealth and seize all of his assets. They're not doing that to George Soros. So there is something to be said for having funding, and we just don't have it.
Yeah, well, that's also another problem. Not that we want to use power, but if the one side uses power to try to destroy the other side, if the other side doesn't respond in kind, it's going to lose. And we're just too nice. You can't be nice if the other side is vicious. I do want to get to the LGBT agenda, but beforehand, actually, I want to discuss why you had a class called Intro to Bible that it makes all students take. Now, I wrote an article years ago saying that the reason actually I always hesitate to recommend YU to people is not because of the science department, not because of the philosophy department. I hesitate to recommend YU to people because of the Bible department.
Yeah, it's weird. I can only speak to what it was 20 years ago, but I can't imagine it's better. But when you're in yeshiva in Israel, you're completely immersed in emuna and learning and Torah, the most saturated you'll ever be in your life. And then you say, I'm going to YU. So there was kind of this alumni network that would inform you, you're going to have to sign up for Intro to Bible. And you have to know that there's a variety of teachers, and some of them, like Rabbi Carmi, are very frum and are great rabbis, and you could actually learn a lot from their class. But some of them are straight up heretics who will teach you the opposite of everything that you believe. And they're way smarter than you. And they've thought about these issues, not just more than you, they've thought of it and you have not. So you will come completely unprepared to a class that ultimately is something that is more the kind of thing that you would hear is happens at a secular university, where a yeshiva student comes back and all of a sudden they teach you that the Bible was really written by a bunch of Ugaritic monks, or whatever, and J and P and E were all hanging out and they wrote the Bible together or whatever their theories are. You don't know anything about that. And you get into this class and they're like, did you know this? And you're not old enough or experienced enough or well-read enough to know anything about this. And why you demanded that you take that class. And it's crazy. You have these yeshiva students who just sat for 2, sometimes 3 years, saturated in Torah. And YU says, hang on a minute. You need an intro to the Bible. Well, I mean, whose idea was that? And I took Rabbi Carmi. I think Rabbi Elman was the other one they said was the good one. I don't want to mention the other ones, but these were, I mean, even Rabbi Carmi and Rabbi Elman, I don't know what, they were told or instructed that they had to teach, but it was just a very strange experience. And we all sat through it because we knew we had to. We were actually, the one good thing is that we were prepared to understand that this was an adversarial class, but it was bizarre.
I think it's still required. And I wrote an article about this years ago. My headline was Shut the Bible Department Down. And I was heavily criticized for this article. And a lot of the criticism was, don't you know the university is an academic place and we're not close-minded? I'm thinking to myself, this is supposed to be a yeshiva first. Historically, it was a yeshiva first. It was a yeshiva. Rabbi Revel made it to university because he was losing all of his best students who were going to City College. So he said, you know what? Let me make a university here so I keep my students. But it is a yeshiva first. So if you're going to throw knowledge at people, and there's no reason why it should be required. Why in the, I mean, I don't know when this became a requirement. Jewish philosophy used to be a requirement. That's no longer a requirement. This is. But if you're going to make it a requirement, you have to have rabbis in charge and rabbis introduce it in a way, or at least have rabbis speak to you about it afterwards. They just like kind of throw this knowledge at you. They don't care at all about your Yerushimayim or at all about possibly undermining the foundations of your Amuna. They couldn't care less. They're almost like joyful as they're throwing this destabilizing information at you. It's bizarre.
Agreed. And not only that, I have no objection to them teaching it in the yeshiva framework. You know what I mean? Say, this is what the evil people say. This is their conspiracy theory about the Bible, how this book that everybody in the world has essentially accepted as that. But there's a conspiracy theory started in Germany by anti-Semites who say that it's not. So we should learn what that conspiracy theory is. And here's what our great sages have said in opposition to them. And here's what Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch said. And here's what Rav Mecklenburg said. And here's all these different things. That would be a great class. That should be required. It's literally the opposite. They literally teach it from the perspective of the conspiracy theorists.
Right. You know, and then they'll tell you, well, look, we're quoting some traditional sources. Okay, you're quoting obscure traditional sources. You're taking one or two statements. And even if they're true, you can't throw that at, like you said, at 19-year-old kids who have just been immersed in a Torah experience their entire lives. You can't throw it at them without any context, without any explanation. You can't just do that to people. You have to...
Not only that, you would leave that class thinking that the Ibn Ezra is a reform rabbi. I mean, I'm not kidding. They cherry pick a few Ibn Ezras here and there, and they, oh, look, he was a Bible critic. The whole thing is bizarre. It makes no sense. And Yeshiva University, if you're watching this podcast, just end this. It's so stupid.
Right. And it's so simple. Just make it a voluntary class. Why does it be mandatory?
No, I disagree with that. It shouldn't be a voluntary class. You should not teach a class teaching biblical criticism from the perspective of the biblical critics in Yeshiva University. That class should not, you can get that class in literally every single university in this country, with the exception of Christian universities. But Yeshiva University should not have that class. It's ridiculous. And on that note, I want to say I visited Liberty University, which the good thing about Liberty University that I think why you should adopt, Liberty University is unapologetic about being a religious institution. It doesn't care that it's not on the top 40 list of institutions. And they, by the way, raise money hand over fist. And not only because there are more Christians, it's because they stand for something. Liberty University officially believes in God. Yeshiva University, that's not something that you would find in the halls of the institutional arm of the university, certainly not in the academic classes. You know, it doesn't have to be that way. I remember I was a math major and I took Norman Rosenfeld, of blessed memory. He was the chair of the math department, one of the deans of the university. And he was a frum guy who wore a yarmulke and believed in Hashem and went to davening every day and learned Daf Yomi. And I remember when he finished Shas, he came into class one day, he was very happy. He said, everybody, you're invited to my Siyum. And that's wonderful. There are enough religious people who can teach all of these secular subjects. And I don't just mean people who wear a yarmulke and then, you know, become a transgender and wear a dress. I'm talking about people who are actually God-fearing.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, YU employed a transgender professor for many years. It continues to employ a Bible professor who urged from Jews to ignore the Torah's views on homosexuality. And it opened a club for LGBT students 2 years ago. Now, YU claims it's not an LGBT club, but it's close enough that even a friendly outlet like National Review reported that it was an LGBT club. YU's president, Ari Berman, meanwhile, twists himself into a pretzel every time he's asked about this topic. Apparently, he isn't able to utter a simple sentence like, the Torah finds homosexual behavior abominable, and therefore we as a Torah institution do as well. What do you make of YU's response to the LGBT agenda over the last few decades? And I say decades because YU's surrender to the LGBT agenda really started all the way back in the 1980s, I think.
Yeah. So I want to preface this by saying that about 2002 or 2003, a documentary came out called Trembling Before God. Do you remember that documentary? Are you aware of that?
I remember reading about it. I did not watch it.
It was a documentary about a bunch of Orthodox people coming out of the shadows who apparently were gay. And that movie came out and accused us of being intolerant. And I remember the outpouring of, no, we're so accepting. It was a blood libel in many ways against the from community. But nonetheless, we all fell over ourselves to say, no, no, we're welcoming, we're welcoming. And no, it's not you. We just have a problem with homosexuality. But it was a trap because it didn't stop there. That was the beginning. That was 20 years ago. And we've seen the progression of it and how that acronym has grown and grown and grown. And it was never just about being nice. There was a much greater agenda. So that was point one. Point two I wanted to make was that every time I hear an official statement from YU say LGBT, I am outraged. Let's start with the B. How is that acceptable? The B, I'm told, means bisexual, which means that you're AC/DC. You can go either way. You can have men or women as your spouse. The answer to that should be, that's great. Marry a woman and don't have adultery. That should be the end of it. What is B? Why is that even a discussion? That should be off the table.
Just to reiterate your point, the B means you have a legitimate kosher outlet for your desires. Completely. Not that you have to force yourself. It's completely natural. And yet, you also want to have forbidden desires. Well, we all have both kosher desires and forbidden desires. Since when is it allowed to just, you know, say, oh yeah, today I want to do my forbidden desires? No. And to your first point, I remember when YU had its first public LGBT type event where you had like three or four students getting up there talking about their experiences. And I didn't go because I thought it was horrific that YU allowed such an event to take place. But I actually read, someone took a transcript, sat there and typed up the whole thing. And I read the transcript afterwards. I think three of the four students who spoke said exactly the opposite of what people claim we do. They said, you know what? When I told my rabbi personally, I came over to him and said, you know, I really have this problem. He was so much more understanding than I thought he would be. When I told my parents, they were so much more understanding than I thought they would be. Meaning if you come privately and say to a rabbi, I have a problem, every rabbi is going to be understanding. We're not understanding when you publicly claim and you get up there and you have a parade and say the Torah is bigoted, you must accept us despite the fact that we're going against the Torah. Then, of course, we're going to oppose you. But if you come to a rabbi on a private level and you say, I have a desire to do an Avera, which rabbi is going to say, get out of my office, you scum? It's just unheard of.
It's laughable. It's laughable.
And YU has been compromising on this for decades. I mean, I forgot to look it up, but I think it started in the 80s with either the law school or the medical school where they gave housing to two men who claimed to be married to each other.
And it was the medical school was two women.
Two women. And they just keep on going from one thing to the next, and they never put their foot down. They never could just say, look, we're a Torah institution. Not look, why do they even have to apologize? Proudly, we're a Torah institution. We stand for biblical values. We stand for the values of Western civilization for the last 2,000 years, for heaven's sake. They won't do it.
No, they will not. And I'll tell you something. When I was a rabbi, I was friends with the Reform rabbi, with the assistant Reform rabbi, and we were comparing kind of what our rabbinical training was like. And he told me that one of his teachers, an older man who was a veteran rabbi, and he gave them a class. And in the class, he just said, I hope that your generation has the guts to do what my generation didn't have the guts to do. And it's to rip out that page from the Torah that talks about not allowing homosexuality. And I respected that man a little bit because, you know, that's their belief system.
And he was honest.
My position, though, is that essentially every time I hear YU apologize for their stance on homosexuality, I hear that rabbi's voice. They're saying that, well, we don't have the guts to rip out that page, but we don't like it. We're hoping that somebody else will do it for us.
I and other people wonder, where's YU was like 20 or 30 legitimate rabbis, you know, not Reform rabbis, but legitimately Orthodox rabbis who believe in Torah, believe in Hashem. Where are they in these issues? They never seem to speak up. They just keep their heads down. I don't get it.
I don't know.
I mean, I always say, I try to their defense. I understand everyone has a different role to play in this world. Not everyone's a fighter. And there are some people, maybe their role in this world is just to sit there and teach Torah. I get it. But you also need to have some fighters. And among those 20 or 30 rabbis, there has to be at least one or two or three who say, I'm sorry, this is not acceptable. You cannot do this in an institution called Yeshiva University. You want to call it Berman University? You want to call it Lamb University? Fine. If its name is Yeshiva University, you can't do this.
Rabbi Braunspiegel and Rabbi Parnas left. And it's not like they had to leave and live lives of poverty. They left and they got very prestigious and I would think fulfilling jobs as being rabbis in Landers University. So I don't know.
Okay. I respect that you don't want to badmouth YU's rabbis, but it is very frustrating. And if you speak to them privately, they'll agree with you like 100% that it's all wrong. So you'll agree with me privately that it's all wrong, but you won't say it publicly?
Yeah. I mean, where is the line? What could YU as an institution do that it has not already done that one of these rabbis will say, well, now they've gone too far? What would that line be? I can't think of what YU would have to do institutionally. They've, forget about the law school and the medical school and the social work school. And I'm sure, I don't know about Faircloth, but I'm sure the psychology school. These schools are totally divorced from the Torah, 100%. They don't even claim to be. Cardozo, I remember years ago, I was talking about like 20 years ago, before Alan Dershowitz was persona non grata for his support of President Trump. He was always an outstanding supporter of Israel. And he went to Cardozo and they basically booed him out of the room because he was speaking in support of Israel. Not recently, this is a long time ago. So Cardozo has never claimed to be a religious institution. I think they proudly say that they're not. Einstein, same. And Wurzweiler, same. What does YU as an institution have to do for the rabbis of Reitz? What would be the line? I'd like to know that.
Just quickly to one thing you said, I met recently a young woman. I think she was in Furkauf, the psychology school. She said as a frum Jew, she was a minority in her class, and she also felt like a minority. She felt like she couldn't say things from the Torah. And when they get paired up with students, she's always paired up with the other fellow Orthodox Jew in the class. Like, hey, you two are Orthodox. You could work together. Like, she feels like she's not welcome there, which is bizarre. But I also, what you're saying about, you know, what they would have to do, it's like that old analogy with the frog and the boiling water, that, you know, it's in the water, they slowly get hotter and hotter and hotter, eventually dies because the water gets so hot, but so slowly that you never quite notice until it's too late. And the last thing I'll say before I leave this topic is, YU's rabbis have tremendous power, and I think they have used it once or twice in the past. I think in the 70s, there was talk of moving the girls' school right next to the boys' school, and I think there was a meeting of the rabbis, and I think they all threatened to resign en masse. They have power. YU can't function without the rabbis. If they came a group of 5 or 10 or 15 of them to the president's office and said, you can't do this or we'll all resign, Rabbi Dr. Berman will have no choice but to give in. But they don't use the power they have.
I agree. And I just want to point out that Elliot and I are not talking anything that's radically right-wing controversial. It's homosexuality is not controversial in the Torah. It says you're not allowed to do it. There's no argument that the Torah is very, very clear on this issue, and therefore that should unequivocally be Yeshiva University's position without apology.
I want to move on to another topic, which is, I guess, more political. In 2015, Yeshiva University's student newspaper reported, based on public records, because your political donations are a matter of public record, they reported that 99% of political donations from YU professors had gone to Democrats. 99%. Not 59%, not 69%, 99%. Since the values of conservative professors align much more closely with those of the Torah, and since conservative professors can't exactly easily find a job in 21st century American academia, why in the world is YU hiring so many liberal professors?
Look, I totally agree. I think that Yeshiva University, if they want to be a great university, a great Jewish university that espouses Torah values, then they should be vetting their professors, and they should be hiring professors either that are completely not political, who, you know, put their nose in their textbooks and are religious Jews. There's no reason. There are enough religious Jews that they can fill up every professorship with a religious Jew. And they would be allowed to do that because they're Yeshiva University and we want religious people teaching our religious students. And they should be religious Jews who are just regular people, or in the alternative, people who are advocating in the public arena for, I don't want to say conservative values, I want to say for Torah values. And they could easily fill up every professorship with one of those two types, and they're not doing that.
I took two or three philosophy classes at YU, and this is an counterexample, I think. He's a believing Christian. Meaning, so when I take a philosophy class, I'm not taking a professor who says, oh, of course God doesn't exist. Of course the morals are relative. This professor thought God did exist. He thought morality only had a good justification if you base it in God. So it was such a machayo, such a, so comfortable.
But at the same time, as if you couldn't find a religious Jew to teach philosophy for Yeshiva University. It's It's shameful that they had a Christian. I would have no problem with a God-fearing Christian teaching math, and then if he sat in the cafeteria and we could schmooze with him about Christian versus Jew, that'd be fine. But for him to be teaching philosophy at Yeshiva University as if there was not a single Torah-believing Jew who is capable of teaching philosophy is shameful.
Okay, well, on this issue, I guess you're a teeny bit more to the right than I am, because he never really brought Christianity into his class. I mean, I think we once started arguing about Jews and Christianity. He said, let's not bring family fights into the classroom.
Yeah, but so he's coming from a place. Liberty University is not going to have a Torah-believing Jew teaching their philosophy class. I guarantee it.
Okay, no, I get your point, but at least it was comforting that we didn't have to fight with him, that he already agreed with our basic views about morality, about God.
I understand.
And it could be like that in all classes. If all professors in the English department, in the psychology department, if all of them came, like in our psychology department, the textbook, and I think our professor also, referred to human beings as human animals. Literally, human animals. We're just another form of animal, maybe a higher form of animal. And it's ridiculous. It's a Yeshiva University, have believing people there. All right, last issue I wanted to bring up with you. It's the same topic, but one reason I get so upset at YU is because I know what YU could be. I know the Kiddush Hashem it could make if it just had a backbone. For example, a right-wing modern Orthodox rabbi recently wrote an article suggesting that YU move to a different state, perhaps somewhere in the South, where it won't be subject to tyrannical LGBT rules. And imagine what a Kiddush Hashem it would make if YU did that. There would be headlines all over the country. Jewish University relocates to Florida, refusing to compromise on biblical principles. YU's president would be on every conservative TV show and podcast. Tens of millions of Christians would see the chosen people acting like the chosen people, leading the fight for truth and biblical morality. And instead, YU compromises and compromises and compromises. And I just find it enormously frustrating. Do you have the same reaction?
Yes, and I'll say this, that I think that if YU wants to save itself, it needs to, obviously, as we've discussed, clean house with its staff and hire religious, God-fearing, Torah-observant people. But I think that it needs to move out of New York, and it should move specifically to a place where there is not a large Jewish community and create, so to speak, an island of Torah values within a place that would be receptive to it, meaning in a nice area in America that is aligned with our values in terms of they believe in the Torah as the word of God, and they believe in the Torah values, not necessarily Jews. And they could be a huge Kiddush Hashem. And it would bring them, first of all, away from New York, which is a cesspool, meaning in terms of its values. It's not a place, and I think that almost everybody would agree with this, when a city gets too big, unfortunately, its values become harder to manage, so to speak. And moving to a smaller place, I lived in Omaha, Nebraska. It's just a much more manageable city because it doesn't have the same size. So moving to a smaller place where the students, just like when they go for their year in Israel, would have to move away from their families and kind of be more in a yeshiva-like environment where the rabbis would have more of a influence on them, where they would have to be by the rabbis for Shabbos, where the rabbis would take the same kind of interest in their personal lives the way that your rabbis in Israel do, and they would have a greater relationship with them. And they could be a beacon to the non-Jewish world in a way that they can't be in New York, where there are so many people purporting to speak for the Jews. You know, the typical New York Jew that is conjured to mind is more of a Larry David or a Jerry Seinfeld. You'll never get, or a Chassid, but you'll never get a thoughtful, quote-unquote, modern Orthodox voice to be able to co-opt that image of the New York Jew. But if they move to a place in northern Florida or in Iowa or something of that nature, then that would be the image of a Jew within that sphere. And they would be able to create a very strong, concentrated Jewish voice. And I want to end with one more thing on that point, is that I have this dream. If somebody steals it, I'm 100% okay with it. But I would like there to be a law school that is accredited, that is a yeshiva, that learns our law. We learn all of the sugyas that are parallel to the common law that we study in law school. So for instance, instead of torts, you study Bava Kamma, and you study them in depth for not just 3 years like in law school, maybe a 4 or 5 or maybe even 6 year program. And at the end, you have an accredited law degree and you can take the bar exam. And while you're in that program, one day a week, the yeshiva opens its doors to the non-Jewish community that surrounds it for a clinic where we'll do free mediation for small claims, landlord, tenant, things like that, or for people who don't have money for litigation, and where we do the things that law schools do in clinical work, where we could do public advocacy, we could do freedom of information, all those kinds of things. And we open it up for free. It's a free clinic that allows people to gain from the Jewish wisdom. And there's no reason that that doesn't exist. It would only be a question of raising the money to do it. We could get amazing staff. There are many rabbis who are very accomplished legal scholars who are also great Talmidei Chachamim who could be the faculty. And it would be a great thing and a big Kiddush Hashem.
All right. On that note, I guess we will end. Thank you so very much for your time and your input and insights. And good luck to you in your own work.
Thank you so much.
All right. That does it for us. If you like this podcast, please consider subscribing to it and giving it a good rating and a nice review if you're so inclined. I hope you enjoyed the episode and have a great day or a great night, depending on when you're listening to this podcast.